to meeting the 14th of February. Happy Valentine's Day, everybody. Happy Valentine's to my wife, Luann. She's watching. Today, we have with us Representative Wilson, Representative Crawford, Representative Stevens, and Fate, Representative Coghill. It's about 6 minutes after eight. Today, we talked income taxes. And we have two presenters, and we have the Department of Administration here. We have House Bill 10 and House Bill 199. Once again, I feel that I should instruct the committee that my intention is not to move anything out today, but to look at what are some of the best options we can come up with, look at the different approaches we might look at an income tax with. And then at the very end, I'm going to ask us to think about what we might take to make our ideal bill, how we might think of a policy, and come back with a CS to the committee to hear. We'll compare that with the sales tax that we were talking about the other day. And then the governor did introduce this bill, so I think that I will allow some latitude today to at least share some of the principles behind it. Then we'll get to hear that next week. I'm going to schedule it today for next week just to make sure that it has a fair hearing. We're joined by Representative James, and good morning. Happy Valentine's Day to you.
Well, thank you.
By the way, Valentine's Day and a 54th anniversary.
Saturday.
Very nice. Congratulations. Nice to have that kind of a journey with a sweetheart.
Yeah,
so,
I bet.
I'm only into the 27th year, so. So income tax. I think the first thing we'll do is we'll allow House Bill 10 to come up from Representative Moses' office, and then we'll take Representative Hudson, House Bill 199, and then I'll have the administration join us after Representative Hudson presents his, and then we'll begin the questions, and I think we'll just compare all of them. So Tim, if you will stay with us so that we can ask questions of all three. And welcome to our committee also. Representative Joe Hayes joins us, and a pleasant good morning to you. Tim, introduce yourself and your bill, please.
Thank you, sir. For the record, Tim Benintendi with Representative Carl Moses' office. Representative Moses is traveling to Dutch Harbor today, so he is winging his way to Anchorage right now and asked me to stand in here. Just to be real brief, in consideration of time, I'll just give you the highlights of our bill, and then we'll follow your game plan. It is an income tax bill. This one, of the three major proposals, would probably be income tax light. It generates probably the least amount of income as it's now written, somewhere between $90 and $100 million. And the main feature that distinguishes Representative Moses' bill from the others is that it provides a credit for property taxes, and that is personal property taxes paid in this state and real estate taxes paid in this state. And on that note, that's a considerable deduction, and that's one of the reasons the income from this bill is considerably less than the others. It's pretty conventional in terms of its setup, and it's modeled pretty much on the income tax that used to be active in this state. So with that, I'll just yield to any questions or...
Thank you, Tim. I appreciate that. Well, there are several questions I have. Let's go to the tax rate first, and... can you show us first of all, the base of how you get to your tax rate?
Yes, sir.
It says here that you're looking at the tax liability, the federal tax liability. Can you explain that fundamental to us?
Yes, sir. As written now, the bill before you, it does graduate the tax, or it brings it in somewhat modestly, and then raises it over the course of 3 years. Representative Moses was interested in if or should we have to go to an income tax? He wanted to get it in and across as easily as possible. And so, for example, in the first year, it would tax people at their, according to their federal tax liability, and it would tax them at 5% of that federal tax liability if their liability is less than $20,000. If their federal tax liability is more than $20,000, they would be taxed at 10%. And then in the second year, it would go to 10% for the under $20,000 and 15% for the over $20,000. And then in the third and final year, it would be 15% in the under $20,000 liability and 20% if your tax liability is over.
So Tim, let's go back to the very beginning of that. If you say not, if the income tax liability is less than $20,000, the taxpayer's liability is 5%. Explain to me what is meant by the federal income tax liability of under $20,000. How do you arrive at that number?
That would be after a person prepared their federal tax filing, their liability, which would be determined on the 1040, would come out to a certain amount. If it's less than $20,000, then the one percentage applies, and if it's more than that, of course, the other would.
Well, that's a key issue, and I want the committee members to pay attention to that, because there's going to be different ways that will come to these numbers, I think the governor has a little different approach, and so does Representative Hudson. And to me, that's a key issue on how we even start the discussion, that tax rate. The other thing is fiduciary. Can you explain to me, I know we have a definition in here, how did you arrive at the definition of fiduciary? I think on page 6 we have the definition. I think we should just walk through that real quickly. Certainly we know what an individual is, but I want to make sure that we have this very clear.
And beyond us having picked that up from the old format, the old income tax structure, I don't know in great detail, or certainly legal detail, why that's there.
Okay, well, here's a question that I'm going to have when we get to the end of this, and the administration can help me with this as well. That one of the things that we've done in Alaska is we have created a trust doctrine that has given real incentives for people to kind of warehouse money here and create trust. And this is going to greatly affect, I think, and I just need to know it, to what degree we're going to affect that whole scheme that we have been building over the last several years. So that's something that I'm interested in the very end. So any other questions at this point? Representative Crawford.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just to clarify, I want to make sure that, say, a person's tax liability, federal tax liability, is $22,000. They'll be taxed on that first $20,000 at the lower rate, and then everything above that will be at the higher rate, or does the whole thing go to the higher rate?
Mr. Chairman, through the chairman to Representative Crawford, no, if they have a federal tax liability above $20,000, the entire amount would be taxed at, in the third year, 20%. There's no apportioning it. It's either or.
Representative Stevens had a question as well.
Okay. Just a couple of brief questions, Tim. First, on the credit for property tax. Now, this is just on personal income tax you're talking about, not corporate. So on personal income tax, is it just your primary home, or is it the credit for people who have vacation homes? How does that work? And the second question, last year, before you answer, is just to make it clear, I understand at what point we're talking about taking 15 or 20%. Is that on line 70, the amount you owe federal government, then 20% or 15% of that line 70 of the tax form 1040?
Through the chair to Representative Stevens, yes, on the latter question. And on the former question, the way the bill is written now, and Representative Moses' intentions were to give the credit for any and all personal or real estate property, personal property taxes paid or real estate taxes paid, it's pretty wide open, and that's one of the features that draws the income down that would eventuate from the tax. a person could, or it could be modified to restrict it to primary residences only. That's compatible with some other programs in the state, so that there are options there to make a change.
Thank you, Tim. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Representative James.
Well, thank you. It is kind of a question, but also a statement, mostly because it's been a long time since we've had state income tax in Alaska, but I've sure prepared a lot of the old ones. And if you're trying to replicate the old ones, I can tell you have a lot of problems with that. One of the questions is it your intent that there would be a separate itemized deduction schedule for the state of Alaska to determine whether there is any income from outside the state or expenses from outside the state on income outside the state that would be recognized as a state tax, and or particularly on part-time residents or non-residents? And then the other issue is, would you be expecting that the federal tax that you do pay would be an itemized deduction when you get down to the taxable amount, like the state tax is an itemized deduction? So if you didn't do that little calculation, you'd find yourself having the state tax deduction, which reduces your tax, which reduces, I mean, it doesn't seem fair to me. And so those are the questions, is what your intent is on this issue. And then my critical statement that if we're going to piggyback on the federal tax at all, I would prefer starting with the adjusted gross income. The reason for that is there's lots of playing around with different benefits of credits and tax credits and so forth at the federal level, which I don't necessarily believe Alaska should be buying into. So if you could respond to that, please.
Yes, ma'am, Chair. The first part of the question, if I understood it correctly, our bill only taxes income from sources within Alaska, so income from outside the state is not taxed. Did I hit that right, or?
Well, yes, that tells me then there's another calculation for that on everyone's tax. We're making the tax return more complicated because now everybody has to separate, and the federal tax doesn't do that.
That could very well be. I'd have to yield.
And that would, just for clarification, that's in Section 5, and it does leave that open. Can you give the rationale behind starting at the liability instead of at the rate that the adjusted gross income?
No, sir, not other than it's Representative Moses' preference. Would never discuss that at
all.
This is the eighth year he's put this bill in, so it's been pretty well worn, but I've just never discussed that with him.
Representative James?
Just one more thing I'd like to get on the record at this point in time, because I avidly supported not a graduated tax but a flat tax, simply because of my experience as well in working in payroll, you know, long time ago, and seeing people get an increase in their pay and getting a smaller check because it bumped them into another higher category. And in my tax preparation experience, finding people when there was an acceleration of larger, that's before we've had the reduction at the federal level, requesting of me to do a calculation that what if their wife went to work, what would the net amount, how much would she be making an hour by the time that put them in a higher tax bracket and paid for child care? That was a calculation I almost did if there was just one person working in the family. And so it seems to me, and my rationale for this is that for those people who work harder, longer, and smarter, why should they work for a smaller dollar? I think the dollar should always be the same size. So that's my rationale. I just wanted to put that on the record.
I think the tax credit against local taxes is a good idea. Now, practically, how we actually work that, I was reading some of the language in here. There's still some technical things that have to be hammered out, I think. But in giving a credit against property tax, do we go down the road of allowing for other carve-outs, other exceptions, and other credits in this discussion?
Mr. Chairman, it's possible there could be some other credits or deductions applied. I suppose it's probably infinite, but on the other point, it's pretty easy to determine what real estate taxes have been paid in this state. I think the department's estimate was $451 million is the amount of property real estate property tax paid in this state. The personal property tax amount is real hard to identify, according to the department. I'm not sure why, although I suspect there are different inclusions from borough to borough or community to community, and they've wrestled with it. And we haven't been able to come up with anything, certainly, to be any more substantial than they are.
So. Property tax valuation has significant effects in other areas of the world as well, not just property tax. Representative Crawford.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Have you done any calculations as to breaking it down from people's personal residence as opposed to their rental property that they might have?
Through the chair, Representative Crawford, no, we have not.
I can see a good reason to have a break for people to have their own residence, but I don't see a good reason for rental property to be.
And two, people might have cabins out in the wilderness or out in other boroughs, things like that. It's pretty generous, but that's what Representative Moses wanted or has wanted all these years.
Okay, thank you.
Representative James had a question.
Yeah, I just have another question, which I'll preface it with a thought. And that is, I had a tax bill about 4 years ago, and one of my purposes for having an income tax bill, which is a flat tax, was to nullify the argument between those people in the rural areas and the urban areas who do or do not help to pay for their education. And so what the main purpose of this provision in my tax was that if you paid a property tax on your residence and a portion of that was for education, you got a credit of the tax, and those people who did not pay a property tax didn't. And I felt that that was a leveling effect which would kind of take this argument away of forcing people to go into a borough or city organization when they really couldn't afford to do that, and there was no real cause for them to do that. But yet, and in the borough, forcing the boroughs on these people so they'll force them to pay for their education. I took long testimony in state affairs about 4 years ago and never heard one person from the rural area ever say they didn't want to pay. They didn't have a provision to pay, and I thought that to that. So had you thought at all about on the property tax exemption, just simply make it the amount that you pay for education on your personal residence?
I haven't heard from Representative Moses that he's thought long and hard about that. One comment I'll make is that those areas in rural Alaska that do not pay a property tax locally, of course, cannot take advantage of the credit we have here. I suspect the reason he's got personal property tax in the bill is to hook in some of those areas that may have personal property taxes, but not local. But I don't know if there are very many of those. I'm just not familiar enough with that.
Okay. Representative Wilson and then Stevens.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. How would this affect a lot of fishermen have a home that does have property tax on it, but their business is their fishing boat, and in a lot of areas there's no property tax on that boat, depending on the area. How would that affect the fishermen?
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, if they pay no property taxes, that wouldn't affect that non-residential property, as far as I'm aware. In other words, if they're not paying tax on that boat out somewhere, they wouldn't be using the credit here.
Representative Wilson.
So then they would have to claim the boat and then pay the tax on the boat. Is that what you're saying?
Well, if there would be no.
I mean, there's no exemption. So how does that? They just don't have to count that at all then, or or that's just a moot point?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
I think that's well said. Representative Stevens.
Mr. Chairman, just a couple questions again. I've forgotten what the old tax was. I keep thinking it was 20%, but people 16. Say no, it wasn't. It was
16, somewhere around there.
Can you give us a definitive answer on that? We seem to be disagreeing. And the second thing is an observation. I remember an old saying in the Army, keep it simple, stupid, and anything we can do to keep it simple, I mean, so the people don't have to hire Representative James to do their income tax or CPAs, and they can do it themselves and do it simply, I think the better off we're going to be.
Yes, through the chair, Representative Stevens, I think the number was 18%, but I'm going from memory, and that was before my time. And then your second point was?
Just keep it simple.
Oh, yes, sir.
In trying to do that, let's just kind of walk down to this. The starting point of the tax here is going to be the federal tax liability. We're talking about a three-year step up where we start off with 5 and 10%, 10 and 15%, and 15 and 20% of the federal tax liability in 3 years respectively. So I guess at this point, that would be the process with a carve out for some local tax crediting. What is the anticipation of income from this to the state?
Mr. Chairman, as the bill's written now, the income has been estimated. Well, let's see. I think the first year was down around $52 million, if we're sticking with the way the bill's written now, the graduated format. And then it went up to, in the third year, $82 million, according to the figures we've gotten from Department of Revenue, which is an estimate. And, of course, that estimate includes their wrestling with the property tax issue, the personal property tax side of that issue. Representative Moses wanted me to be sure to mention today that he has changed his mind on one factor, and that is he would like to see his bill changed to where he just starts out at the third year level. He wants to pull the graduated feature. And so just for whatever that's
worth. So just for the committee's heads up.
It realizes the income's real light and lighter, I guess, than he was hoping. But nonetheless, that's an option.
Okay, and then the burden to the individual, then, as I understand it, is to go ahead and fill out the federal tax form, and that has to be submitted to the state with our form, whatever that is, starting at whatever the tax liability is. And then the state form would, as I understand you correctly, give them the multiplier, whatever that percentage was.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, the person would have to actually submit a copy of their federal tax filing to the state, and the state would retain it in their records for some period of time.
And then the other thing is the anticipation of what a resident is. Are we going to run afoul of how do we describe a resident, non-resident?
Mr. Chairman, I don't think so. Representative Moses, of course, was most anxious to hook in out-of-state workers who actually work up here. Most of them are seasonal tourism and fisheries workers. And, you know, in that regard, the bill covers that. Under the way the bill's written right now, the estimate of income from that pool of workers is less than $3 million. But again, it's because the way the bill is structured otherwise. But that's always been one of his objectives, is to have them pay more of their share or more of their way up here. And so it's in the bill now. It's a fairly modest amount. But that is subject for amendment.
Representative Stevens?
Sir, maybe you've asked this, Mr. Chairman, I'm not sure, but if you do earn salary in Alaska, you can only be given credit for property tax you pay within Alaska.
Through the chair, yes, sir.
Thank you. Okay, well, recognizing the sponsor's willingness to amend out the step-up, then we would arrive at the 15% and 20% of the federal income tax liability. Representative Stevens? I mean, William Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just want, what was that figure then? How much would that bring in? What was the total?
We didn't actually get to the last number.
That's what I was wondering.
Under the third year, the third tier of the bill, the way it's written now, the income from this tax would be between $90 and $100 million, probably closer to 90. And that, I'm sorry, I should throw in that that is not net of the cost of the program. Last year, we had an estimate of the administrative costs at about $3 million. I understand now it's up around $7 million. I don't know how substantial our estimate was last year. Possibly the administration can address that. But
and we will have the administration come forward.
So we have to pull that out of our number.
And Tim, for your information, we did get a kind of a comparison sheet from the administration that actually is going to compare all of them. So that gives us a chance to at least dig into your bill a little bit and the questions I had on the how it started, what the premise was, how the process is. What the burden to the taxpayer is, what the income to the state is, and what a resident is. So I think that kind of does help us summarize that a little bit better. And is there any other process questions or overall questions of the bill itself? I think that outlines it fairly well, recognizing that the step-up process at this point is something he would rather amend out. So I'm just going to lay that on the table right now. We'll put it aside, and then we'll ask, I'm sorry, Representative Crawford.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. At the time that we do start this amendment process, I'd like to make a conceptual amendment to keep the property tax just for personal residences.
I appreciate that. And when we get to the process of actually building a bill, and that's kind of how I envision this whole thing, is us taking one of these as a vehicle and building into it the things that we think should be good policy. And I think we should hammer that out. Before we get to that, though, I think what I'll bring is a CS of the sales tax back. Then we'll go back and hammer that one out. And I think that kind of discussion has to happen in this committee. Among other discussions that I intend to force along the way, one of them will be, what are we going to do with the earnings of the permanent fund? You know, so those all part of the formula, I think, as we go down this road. Tim, I sure appreciate you letting us pepper you with questions, and I think we have at least a basic idea of the bill. We didn't get into it technically so much, but I appreciate that. And at this point, I'm going to ask, did you have any other testimonial to come forward on this one before I let you go?
Chairman, all right. Not to press the time.
I'm going to try to remember to ask people that. But so let's go ahead and have Representative Hudson come on up then for House Bill 199. And Bill, welcome to the committee. And
thank you, Chairman.
Just to let you know that as a chairman, I've appreciated your work. As an individual, I've opposed it some, but that has nothing to do with the amount of respect I have for the work that you put into this, and I greatly appreciate it.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman, and thank you so much for hearing this bill and the other bills, I might add, because I think that this is some of the more important business that is before this legislature. And I'd like to, first of all, I think when you're looking at policy, you have to have a reason for even considering taxes, for example. And so I brought along, Mr. Chairman, this little graph, which is predicated upon the most current figures that we have from the Department of Revenue and OMB and others. And it just simply points out, obviously, that the general fund revenues and the general fund expenses are, by all estimates, looking at producing a fiscal gap of, in 2002, the year that we're in right at the present time, that ends on June 30th of this year, is going to be now in excess of $865 million because of price reductions from when this graph itself was put up. But as you can see, by 2003, and beyond, we're looking at a $1 billion shortfall and the amount of money that we are going to require in order to balance out our book, which we have a constitutional responsibility to do. And so, working with the Fiscal Policy Caucus and having been working on this issue, and frankly, taking some of my lead from the majority leader here some years back, we have put together what we think at any rate is one element of a cure, or at least a portion of the cure, to this fiscal gap, to try to increase the recurring revenue stream so as to avoid, you know, falling off the edge of that cliff, that proverbial cliff. As you can see in this particular instance, the Constitutional Budget Reserve, which has become the filler, is by both estimates by 2004 expected to essentially be gone. And when that occurs, then obviously there's only one other major account that's readily available, and that's the earnings reserve or the permanent fund. And when that occurs, then all of a sudden, schools and public safety and maintaining our roads and matching federal money and keeping our prisoners in prisons and things of this nature will be in competition with the permanent fund dividend. And according to the permanent fund top advisors who just spoke before the House Finance Committee 2 days ago, they tell us that the entire fund could be negatively hurt if we start trying to feed both dividends and making up the fiscal gap out of the earnings of the permanent fund. That right now you've got an earnings reserve account that tries to level things out there so that they've got enough money to inflation-proof the fund and to pay the dividends. And I only point this out because I served on this committee for eight of my 16 years, I guess, and four of my 16 years. I was two terms in here. And I know that you have to consider policy, and then you have to consider the elements of the policy. And so with that, I'll leave this aside like this, because I think that sort of makes the case as to why I'm even foolish enough to be willing to be an author of such an onerous thing as returning taxes to the state of Alaska. I might add, just before I commence here, that I've had numerous conversations with my good friend and former mentor, Jay Hammond, who laments the fact that he permitted the personal income tax to totally be removed from the books. He felt like he should have suspended it. Nonetheless, what was done was done. For 20-some-odd years now, people in Alaska paid no income taxes, received a dividend, and watched, I think, oil build many of the wonderful things that we have in the state of Alaska. We have a lot of other major policies. Mr. Chairman, first of all, I must suggest that I have a sponsor substitute before you, and I would ask the committee to adopt sponsor substitute for House Bill 199 so that we can
the J version?
Speaking on it. It is the J version, but it would need to be adopted in lieu of the original bill.
Right. It's been moved that we have the J version for sponsor substitute for House Bill 199 before us. Is there any objections to that? Hearing none, that is the version we have before us, Representative.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, essentially what I have come up with here is a percent of federal gross income, a flat tax. I tried to make it as simple as possible. It starts with a flat tax of 1% of the adjusted gross income in the first year, so as not to be too weighty on any taxpayer in the state of Alaska. And I think that it would probably I think we figured it would be something in the neighborhood of about $350 per household in the first year, and something in the neighborhood of about, on an average salary across the state of Alaska, of about $680 per household in the second year. So the first year, we take 1% of the adjusted gross income, and then we ratchet it up to 2.25% of the adjusted gross income in the following years. The estimated new revenues for the first year after implementation of this bill at 1% would be approximately $118 million. In the second and subsequent years at 2.25%, the yield would be approximately $285 million. And I will add that by all of the figures that we've seen, that it would be about half of the taxes that were paid by Alaskans under the old tax mechanisms, which was far more complicated. I paid those taxes, and you managed them, Madam Majority Leader. We believe that if this were to be adopted, the average cost per Alaska household would be less than $900 per household's new tax liability. And even if we had a decreased permanent fund dividend, which I suggest the committee has to recognize, because in a week you're going to be taking up that element of how to fill a $1 billion gap, even at a reduced dividend of, say, $1,000 per household or per individual, households with two people in it are still going to be able to pay some money for the services of government and still essentially buy one of their dividends. We believe that at the higher range that it'll be considerably, not considerably, it'll be some more. We have fashioned the bill, and I'll go to the, I think you have the comparison, the across-the-board comparison. In the governor's bill, we'll go down to the bottom, and you will see that it brings in $350 million, but it's predicated upon the tax after federal the deductions. Our bill brings in $285 million. It's a flat tax, and it is on the adjusted gross income. I believe that that's the right table to go to, because from here on out, every change that is made to the federal law will affect the state law if we go to the second page, so to speak, of the tax form. And who's to say that one person's deductions, like a second home, for example, or tax relief on a mobile home, or you know, various other investments or equities they might have, is what Alaskans should adopt as the basis for taxation. In our bill, everybody who receives income or taxable income will pay in the first year 1%, even a permanent fund dividend. A permanent fund dividend of $1,000 would pay $10. It would be the first tax back, which Governor Hammond has indicated he thinks that that's one of the elements that we should look at, is that if you want to take some of the permanent fund money, rather than capping it, tax it back. So this would be the first approach at something of that nature. If the child has a permanent fund dividend, it is now included in the adult's income tax, and so it would still essentially be tapped. Somebody mentioned, what about rural Alaskans who pay no taxes, who receive exceptionally high governmental money for education, for example, on a per student basis? I heard something like $20,000 per student in certain certain districts. This would at least begin to take some of that money back. How does it treat non-residents? There are 65,000 non-residents that are employed in the state of Alaska in 2000, in the year 2000. Those 65,000 non-residents took home to their states of Washington, Idaho, wherever they came from, California, something close to $905 million, paying not one thin dime to the state of Alaska. Mr. Chairman, we believe that they should start paying. We believe at 1% that would cost them approximately $9 million. At 2.25%, it would be 18 or close to $20 million. That's $20 million that, again, from my good friend Jay Hammond, we can't let these people come up here, take the bounty of the state of Alaska, incur costs to the state of Alaska in the form of health and social services and education and corrections and health and things of that nature, and not pay a portion of that. So this would begin to at least take some of the money that is leaving the state of Alaska and bring it back in so that it could work up into here. We have tried to put together, ask for a model to get some ideas as to how the bill would affect Alaskans. I don't know if you have that in their packet. You have it in your packet. It is essentially the 1999 data. It's based on the 1999 tax year. That was the one that they could give us. And if you look at the percent of adjusted gross income, which is our bill, and it says at the very top in the box, $285 million, and you follow it all the way down to the revenue that it would generate, in the up to $20,000 range, the zero to $20,000 range, if you look at the four graphs going, or the graphs going down, was everybody on that? Did you see that? Okay. You'll see that there were 142,000 in households in that particular realm, and that those people would pay out of this $285 million, approximately $24 million. And if you follow it across, you can see how much each one of these tax categories of adjusted gross income would end up paying. So it runs all the way from $24 million at the bottom end to $87 million at the top end. And that, incidentally, is essentially what is done by all of the other tax measures as well. Following that, I think you'll see one that we have modeled on the governors, for example. And the governor's that is before the committee at the present time, the governor's bill, it would run at the lower end $11 million of 350 to $165 million at over 100,000. So, and I incidentally, I went back and I modeled the last one that the governor had put together as well. And I think one of the reasons that the legislature in its wisdom chose not to take up the governor's proposal that he submitted several years ago was, at least what I heard from my colleagues, was that it took far too little from people at the low end of the spectrum and far too much for people at the high end of the spectrum. So what we tried to do was to pick a method that balanced it out to the extent possible. Those people who make more money clear to be paying more of the bill. But people at the low end of the scale, too, also receive most of the services and should they pay part of the cost. And so I think what we have put together is a model adopted. Now you can do anything you want to with figures. If you don't like the 1%, you can eliminate it. You want to start it next year, start it next year. You get less money. You don't get that $100 million first year. We put that in there because there is going to be a cost of setting up the tax mechanism. We're going to have to pay money in order to set this whole monster back up there. And incidentally, while I'm on that matter, I disagree with the governor's fiscal note. The governor has come up with a $12 million in the first year, dropping to about $7.5 million thereafter. I like to go back to the governor's last fiscal note, which was when he put it in on his own bill, and it was only $3.5 million, roughly speaking. So whatever we do, I can guarantee you, as a member of the Finance Committee that will hear this bill next, I'm going to make certain that the cost is not inflated. And I'm not suggesting that that's the case, but I'm suggesting that that's a suspect that I have. So I guess, Mr. Chairman and members, I did leave a copy of the federal 1040s, and if you can kind of look at that, you'll see that my tax applies to line 33 on the 2001, and I suspect it'll be the 2002 tax form. So anybody in Alaska will be able to look at line 33 and take 1% of that.
Representative James had a question.
Okay. I haven't memorized what your language is in the CS, which I've just seen here. I didn't even memorize the one that was before us. But my question is, I assume that on this schedule here you have of identifying federal tax returns, that you are identifying federal tax returns with an Alaska address. As opposed to any Alaskan residents who are filing a tax return with a different address. And then also, what I would think you'd be leaving out here would be also those people who work in Alaska and not the full time and have other income out in other states and file a tax return out there, the same people that we're hoping to be able to help us to pay, how do you include them in the tax return, and how do you differentiate between Alaska residents and non-residents with Alaska income?
Give me a moment, please. The non-residents, I believe, and we have the gentleman here, Slotnick, from the Department of Revenue, and perhaps he could help us out here a little bit on... I think we take a percentage of it so that whatever percentage of their income is made in the state of Alaska is taxed by the state of Alaska. Okay, thank you.
We have somebody from the administration. Please, put your name in the record, please.
For the record, my name is Chuck Carlin, the Department of Revenue. Could you repeat the question?
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. My question is how this particular piece of legislation differentiates between Alaska residents who may have income from somewhere else, but we're assuming are going to be taxed because they're Alaska residents, and those who have income here who are not Alaska residents, and filing their return from somewhere else. Also, there may be Alaska residents who are filing with an outside of Alaska address. I'm only referring to the schedule here that Representative Hudson has identifying what the revenues might be from this tax. That's what my concern is. If the other part isn't fully defined, we can deal with that in the language of the bill. But I just wanted to know in this little projection here how that is addressed.
Mike would be a better person to answer to the chair, I'm sorry. Revenue impact of residents versus non-residents. In all three of the bills, essentially the treatment of residents and non-residents is the same in terms of if you're a resident, we tax you on all of your income. And then if you happen to have business in another state and are taxable there, we'll give you a credit based upon the taxes you pay the other state. And that's pretty much the same through all the bills. Similarly, if you are a non-resident, we tax you on the income that is deemed to be earned in Alaska. So that's the difference. If you're a resident, we tax you on all your income. If you're a non-resident, you get taxed only on the income that is deemed to be earned in Alaska. And the differences between the three bills on those, on that issue, is how you make that determination. And the only difference between the three bills is, in essence, how you calculate the fraction of income that is earned in Alaska. And fundamentally, there's not a great difference.
Okay. So just to follow up on that, however, since this tax is based on the adjusted gross income, you don't have the playing with the numbers on the rest of getting to the tax in this one as you would in the other, because where you'd have to have whether property tax from another state is deducted from your federal, and that wouldn't be allowed, and or other, any other business expenses. And that's one of the concerns that I have is the 2106 types of deductions at the federal level for people who may have some expenses working in the state. How does that relate? Because now the 2106 doesn't come on the front like it used to. It comes on the identified, the itemized deductions.
Through the chair, I think you are right that when you apportion the tax on the federal tax, you incorporate all of the deductions that are inherent in the federal tax liability. And when you don't go that far down your tax return, so to speak, and stop it at adjusted gross income, you avoid any impacts of
Second homes in Washington State.
Yes.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, I apologize. You know, I've been working with two different versions myself here, and so I'm becoming educated as I go along here. But on page 4 of the draft that you've now adopted, it does cover the credit under A of this section for a non-resident. which multiplies the tax computed by a fraction, the numerator of which is the income derived from sources in other state or territories. And so I think this is, Jeanette, I think this is the way it was done in the past. The very basic reason I urge the committee to seriously consider how complicated we want to make this. If we go to that second page where you get all of these federal deductions and where that's constantly in flux right now, even in Washington, D.C., I mean, they're talking about reducing taxes and giving credit for this and credit for that and everything else. I think we're better off to do something that is a very small percentage of whatever the actual wage is on the bottom of this whole thing, a very clear, straightforward, flat tax. And then you don't have to worry about the question of whether or not somebody from California is up in here and going to go ahead and try to claim through the federal tax mechanism, at any rate, all of these other adjustments and end up, you know, Alaska holding the bag. We want to try to get a fair return on any and every wage that's earned in the state of Alaska before all of these political exemptions and other manipulations that are taking place by the federal government. We don't want to be held control by the federal government. That's the reason that I put this substitute in.
And as I understand it then, Representative Hudson, the ability for us to start the laundry list of exemptions and or deductions would be an, we'd end that argument.
Yes, it would. Yeah.
So, Representative James.
Thank you, Representative. I agree with Bill Hudson.
Thank you very much. Any other questions? And thank you for stepping forward to help us with that question.
Thank you very much. I'll get your name and you'll get a Valentine later. Chairman, if I might also, and I like to at least leave it with the committee, this is the fiscal note that was prepared by the governor, by the Department of Revenue, when he put his tax bill forward a couple of years ago here. And I'd like to make sure that I leave a copy of this with you.
I'd appreciate that.
So that the committee members know what I think, at any rate, the fiscal note ought to be.
I appreciate that, and I think that should be part of our consideration when we start folding things together.
And I guarantee you it will be, Mr. Chairman, when it hits the Finance Committee. I'm at your pleasure or displeasure.
And I do have a couple of questions, but I'll save mine and let Representative Stevens first.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Hudson, I always appreciate seeing your charts because it makes things so simple and understandable. And if you go to the bottom line, I just want to clarify the issue of the permanent fund dividend. If we do nothing, the impact on the permanent fund dividend will be a reduction, a regular reduction. Is that your understanding?
Absolutely. And that's their testimony 2 days ago when they had their experts in the House.
Thank you.
Representative James.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think another thing I want to put on the record now, that while we're going forward and trying to figure out a fiscal solution, we've called it a fiscal policy, we've called it a fiscal plan, I think it's a fiscal solution. And when we're doing that, another part of this picture has to be more economic areas in the state. The big boom that we had and the big surplus that was provided at the federal level was not a surplus from an increase in the tax percentage or the tax conditions. It was because more people were making more money. And from my overall perspective, on the hole we have to fill, I say it's like this. And here is the nearly $1 billion, and it goes this way. And I'm not convinced that the amounts of taxes that we can collect from the existing earners in this state can sustain itself if we don't have more higher wages and more people working and increase the revenues, not by raising the tax rates, but by having more people pay. Because I want to be sure that that's on the record, that if I'm going to be supporting any kind of taxes at all, we have to have some method of addressing how we're going to get more people making more money in the state.
Mr. Chairman, if I might,
Representative Hudson, yes,
lady, I totally agree, and I would hope at any rate that we would see that this is an element that will begin to make the connection between expanded workers in the state of Alaska and the expanded costs and how it's going to be paid for. There's this thing that has now been clearly identified as the Alaska disconnect, which says that if you increase the economy in the state of Alaska, where 1,000 people, you know, come in and into the state of Alaska and maybe open up businesses, a microchip factory in Nematsu, building General Electric dishwashers in Fairbanks, whatever the situation might be, that the more workers that come into the state of Alaska to essentially do that, the heavier the burden is on the services that they require, schools and etc. And yet they pay nothing. So what they end up doing is that they cost us money and then they dilute our dividend. Those of us who are already up here now have a divisor. Let's say we had another 10,000 people come into the state of Alaska. You'd have 10,000 more people divided into the same amount of money, and so everybody's dividend would be less. So I agree with the majority leader, but I put that on because I think that's an essential element to consider even beyond whether or not this is the right, you know, filling the gap, if this is the right one piece of it.
Appreciate that. Representative Fate.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. In this discussion, excuse me, you're both absolutely correct, but you have to understand also that to bring in more people requires more jobs, which means that we have to create a condition in the state of Alaska that is friendly to the increase of industry, of businesses, and so we have to think of that. That's certainly number one. But within that area also is the restraint on spending. And every time we talk about taxes, and this is a policy issue that we have to look at, every time we talk about Broadway-based taxes, regardless of whether it's an income tax or sales tax or whatever kind of tax, in that same breath, we're going to have to look at the other side, which is state spending and the restraint on that spending. So I certainly appreciate Representative Hudson bringing this up. But as long as we're talking about the gap and just not taxes, it should be said that if we're going to erase that gap in any way or pinch that gap in, we're going to have to look at all those issues and not just a broad tax.
Mr. Chairman, I totally agree.
And I thank you. And that was going to be one of the questions that I was going to get to a little later on is the expected revenue from a tax such as this. If I understand the upward pressure for this year's budget, would only just fill the expansion of our government or very close to that. And that's troubling to me. And it's going to be very difficult for me to go to my constituents and say, well, we'll expand it with this tax, and then next year we'll start biting into the deficit. And it's such a troubling discussion. But I think that this part has to be part of the discussion as well as the other. And as Representative James said, we've got to take our hands off some of the places where we've made it harder for businesses to grow in Alaska. So, but I want to get to a couple of technical questions,
okay.
Representative James.
Just one more thing, piggybacking on what Representative Fate said, however, and also what Representative Coghlan said about the spending side of the issue. Certainly, in the state, where the state has 100% of control over all the resources and how business is created, that it's going to be very difficult to be making more money in those areas if we don't have sufficient amount of folks on the payroll that are able to do the kinds of things we need to give prompt service to requests for permits and other kinds of information to help people to understand that this is a state that is truly open for business and expedites things as quickly as possible. So when we're determining how the budget should be reduced and where we're continuing to decrease spending, we need to not just look at the overall picture, but we need to look at the specific areas as to what do we need to do to create this atmosphere where people would be interested in doing business here.
I think as a chairman of the Resources Finance Subcommittee, we heard part of that discussion yesterday. Very difficult. There are areas that if we do not add more expertise in, put some money into, then it's not going to grow. So, you know, the thing that we're trying to attract people to, on one hand, we're cutting on the other hand. It's a very difficult question. So, there are other areas of our economy that expand rather rapidly certainly we need to discourage that expansion. So,
Mr. Chairman, I think we're all on the same page in that respect. I believe we're all on both sides of the aisle. We are all attempting now to try to constrain the growth of government because it's like Topsy. It grows just the natural cost of living increase. More students that go into the schools, more seniors that become seniors, requiring more people who fall under the Medicaid umbrella and require the matching money for the umbrella, and et cetera. As we heard yesterday in our subcommittee, now we're beginning to balance whether or not we can even keep parks open in the state of Alaska, as opposed to putting more money into geological engineers and accountants to make certain that the state receives the maximum amount of money from the sale and discovery of our oil and things of that nature, and the gas line, etc. And I will say that, I'm an optimist, and I know that everybody that I've talked to here is as well, is that, yes, we have to try to fill this gap. We've got to try to slow down the consumption of that thing, try to preserve the dividend to the extent that we can. I don't think we can do it all together. You'll hear that next Saturday, a week from this Saturday. But I absolutely agree that we have to clear up the regulations to make certain that the private industry can step forward, invest their money, create jobs, and make a profit. And so we've got a mighty big job. And this is just one little step to try to fill an emergency gap, in my opinion.
And I appreciate you stepping forward. And as the chairman of the State Affairs Committee, my reluctance to tax is based on our reluctance to restrain the growth of government, which is a very difficult thing to do. However, I think we have to go forward to the discussion, and I'm hoping that this will lift the discussion that I need to have and show me not only the details of where we're going to get the money from, which we're going through now, but show me the details of how we're going to constrain ourselves so that we don't go further into debt. And so in that, I did want to ask a couple of technical questions on this. In Section 1, you have, under Part D, 2D, you have you're actually including the cost of living that comes to people. It's a cost of living allowance that is exempt from the
cost
federal tax.
Cost of living allowance, yes.
Could you explain a little bit of how we do that? And I was just wondering if we could even do that. As I was reading it last night, I thought, can we do that?
We can do that because our tax is entirely different than the federal tax. The federal tax laws excludes the federal cost of living, which varies anywhere from, I think, 18% to 25%. It used to be a flat 25%. Every employee from, say, California that was reassigned to the FAA or U.S. Fish and Wildlife, whatever it might be, that came to Alaska received a 25% cost of living allowance, but it was not taxed. We're suggesting that all income, again, looking for the pure side down here, is all income, and we think that's part of the income, and if they can get a deduction from the federal government, that's fine. Now, if we go to the second page, then they're going to get the credit for that because it's in the federal makeup.
And I agree that the flat tax is probably the best place to do it because it's the simplest, and you pay on your ability to earn, which I think is also a good. And my concern about an income tax is actually putting downward pressure on the very thing we want to increase, and that is our labor workforce and our ability for income increase. One of the other things that I was curious about is one of the things we've done in Alaska, as I mentioned earlier, is allowing for the whole trust world to grow in Alaska. Do you anticipate that this percentage is going to throttle us back? I've heard people comment that we put a lot of work into getting here, and now we're going to put a cap on it, kind of.
And Mr. Chairman, that is one area that I would suggest that the committee might want to take a look at. As the author of this bill, I wouldn't have any problem whatsoever and find an exemption to the trust, because I was in the legislature when we passed the legislation to try to encourage more trust management in the state of Alaska. It does accrue a profit to the state of Alaska, so we need to take a look at whether or not, you know, taxing that element would maybe drive that business to some far-off island or something like that, the Island of Man or something like that. In my draft before you today, I did not address that. I will personally take a look at that, so when I come back before you again, we can try to address that. I'd be happy to deal with you and
it'd be my commitment
the chairman of the judiciary and others.
Mm-hmm. I would really like to look into that.
If there's a way to separate between trusts that are from outside and trusts that are made within Alaska, I think we should do that.
Good idea.
So that's something that just kind of jumped out at me as I was reading this last night, things that I would be interested in. And then the other thing would be, before we let the administration speak to it, how you perceive the process. Already you've already spoken to the cost, maybe, but could you help me with the process of how an employer might see this, how a state might see this in administration?
In the first year, there would be no withdrawals by the employer. I am suggesting that this tax commence on January 1, 2002, essentially retroactive, and it would be 1% of the adjusted gross income, and notification would go out to all people. Essentially, the forms and setup and all of that type of stuff would have to take place from the date this was actually passed into law by the Department of Revenue, and they would have to make the necessary system changes, begin to put together the electronic computations, the schedules, the worksheets, communications, and so that would take care of. That's why it's only 1% of the first year. It covers the cost of setting it all up and still provides about a surplus, I think, even at their figures, of about $80 to $90 million to actually start applying against that debt. The first year does not really appreciably affect that debt. That means we're going to have to go into that constitutional budget reserve for whatever difference we might not achieve. But in the second year, then employers would begin, they would have the forms, the department would have set up the mechanisms, and the withholding would take place on a periodic basis, and the money would flow to the Department of Revenue. And the whole sum would be in there, and individuals would file it, I presume, at any rate, by essentially filing the appropriate page of their federal income tax, or their adjusted gross income, or their W-2 forms. But that's the detail, Mr. Chairman. I hope we don't. I must tell you that I'm not. I need to have that discussion once it looks like this is going forward with the Department of Revenue.
Absolutely, and I just wanted to see how you envisioned it at this point. And
that's how I.
And that gives
it.
Us a basic framework is all I'm looking for, because we're going to have to talk about not only conforming language to IRS and all that. I think that's going to be have something when we finally get down to the last draft. We're going to have to make sure that that's all in there. But one of the other questions that kind of comes to mind is in Alaska. Without an income tax, there are many things that we're not able to track that, say, other states are able to track for statistics that are economically kind of verifiable. So when we go to an adjusted gross income, which is a flat tax, gives us a different look at the economy, say, than looking at the federal tax liability. Have you thought about what that might do for us to gauge how we would provide services? Has that been part of the thought process?
No, I have not.
Okay. And I might ask the administration, they might have looked into that as well. Because I think as a state that provides so many services, this is going to give us a look into the economy that we haven't had for the last 20-some years.
Well, one thing it will do, Mr. Chairman, I think you're right on in this respect, is it will give the people of Alaska an ownership into the compendium of services that are provided in their behalf. So people will legitimately be able to look the bureaucrats in the eye and the politicians in the eye and say, you're taking my tax dollar, I want to make darn certain that you're using those tax dollars in the most cost-efficient way. As it is at the present time, the people pay zilch and receive everything. So there's no, in my opinion, no downward pressure on those of us who they elect to administer and to make laws. This will certainly provide that nexus between the taxpayer and the government. That,
I think there is a nexus, though, Representative, and this comes from the other point of view, and that is just using some of the earnings of the permanent fund has been such a political pressure that it has driven us right to this very discussion. And I think that in itself has had pretty much the same pressure that you speak about that would come from taxing. It's just come from a different venue, if you will. But I still think it's pressure on the state government to say, we're not interested in growth of government. And yet, on the other hand, I can see that a dividend given to people doesn't have quite the same cost to them. So, I mean, there's a legitimate part of that discussion, but the downward pressure on government has certainly come from those who view the permanent fund dividend as part of that pressure.
That will be a major part of our discussion next week.
And we'll get to that on the Saturday the 23rd for those of who are listening in.
I just, Mr. Chairman, if I might.
Yes, ma'am.
Just one
Representative
more
James.
On the issue of retroactivity. And, you know, there's a lot of pain out there and a lot of distress right now as we've been talking about taxes. And to make it retroactive, I think, is a wrong way to go, because people are going to really object to having had it be taxed for something that they didn't know was taxed when they got it. So I would urge us to talk about making it effective on January of 2003 and implement the withholding at the same time. Just as a matter of respecting, I think, those folks out there. I can remember some retroactive federal laws, particularly when my husband had to start paying on 85% of his Social Security. And that, you know, that was a chunk that we didn't know we were going to have to do. So it just seems to me like that if you want to get cooperation and understanding from the general public that putting on a tax that is retroactive has a negative effect, and I think we should consider those people. There's one more just comment. I'm sorry to take so much
James,
time here.
This is part of the discussion.
We had the close-up students here this last week, and I can tell you this is just a very encouraging group of young people and their attitude, and having them in my office and talking to them. And I want to put this on the record as well, and they understand that. These are the kids that are really wanting to be involved in government and having some say in how we run our country, which is that's what makes democracy great. And so I have consistently said, and I want to say it again, that this system that we have is flawed, but it is the most perfect system there is going, and it does give people an opportunity to participate in the government. It is a government of the people, by the people, for the people, and it's the people part that's not working when we can't even get 50% of the people to be informed and go to the polls to vote. And one of the other things I want to say is that I have my staff check the district and the party of everyone that complains or has something to do with, and have done that over the years, and it's amazing how many of those are not even registered. So I just want to be sure that the public, if they're listening, if they want to have some say in government, they need to participate. We all need to walk down this path together because that's what this country is built on. And it doesn't say that we are ever guaranteed a free lunch. So I think we should be paying for some of the services that we want, and then we'll be more interested in how they are affected. And I appreciate you coming forward with this piece of legislation.
I do have a vocabulary question, though. So on page 3, line 25, there's a word. I didn't get a chance to look it up last night. Now, maybe you could help me understand what it is. Page 3, line 25. I certainly understand what taxable business is. But what's a citus?
I think it's location, but I'm not sure.
That's showing my ignorance, but I'm not even sure.
So.
Situs is where it's located.
It's where it's located?
Mm-hmm.
Thank you very much. I should have asked her before I had the meeting. And just Representative Wilson,
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. In the discussion that we had just a little bit earlier, when we were talking about the deficit that we have is so great that we can't cut our way out of it, and we can't tax our way out of it, and we can't grow our way out of it. So we have to do a combination of all three. I just want it to be put on record that in a lot of areas of the state, even though there has been some growth, and even though there's a lot of people that have jobs, those jobs, the pay is less than what they used to be getting. And so we really need to think about how we can grow the economy and grow it in ways where people can afford to make a living, because that is one big point that has been brought out in several studies, is that there may be more people employed, but their wages are much less than they were used to living on before. And so we really need to look at all three aspects and make sure that we can somehow grow our economy with wages that are up where people can make a living.
Absolutely, and I think the sponsor of the bill agrees with that, and everybody on the committee. I think one of the disconnects that we talk about many times when it comes to taxes, and I appreciate the Representative James' analogy on it, is since the 1960s when we had the move for the Great Society and we had Medicaid and Medicare kind of come in, we had the move towards a greater and stronger centralized government, and many times we in the state have felt the rebellion, if you will, of that has come to us as a state, and we've had to swallow a lot of things here in the state, and myself included, kind of resist that growth to a stronger, centralized and more subsidized world where we're actually changing money from one group of people to another, and we're doing that redistribution that has such a socialist kind of background to it. So many of us are so reluctant to continue that type of government growth that when we come to these discussions, it's very painful for us to just wave it off, even though we know we have the need. But how do we change the form of government from going further down that road and maybe recovering back to a more free market economy where we're balanced out by competition and the individual liberties? So those are all part of the discussion. I really appreciate you coming forward. I'm going to ask the administration to come kind of go down through the sheet, maybe answer some of the questions you had on the fiscal part. And before we do that, though, we have Representative Crawford.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I have a concern that I'd like to voice. I really believe that you're on the right track here. I mean, I've talked with you numerous times in the fiscal policy group, and I know that we have to do something and do it soon. But as I was walking through my district, I listened to a lot of stories from a lot of different people, and many of these stories really affected me, and most of them were from people at the very bottom. One lady that I talked to, she lives in a condo not far from where I live, and she's retired. She's a widow. She says that the income she gets through Social Security and some other, well, the longevity bonus, that's what it takes for her to have a place to live, to have shelter, that she eats from the permanent fund dividend. With you starting this out at, based just on adjusted gross income, it's going to hit her fairly hard. I mean, I understand that you want everybody to pay their share, but these people at the bottom, it's going to hit them.
Well, if you look at the, if I might, Mr. Chairman.
Yes.
If you look at the, I think I've included some tax forms, the 1040, the 1040A, and the 1040EZ, and I'm assuming at any rate this lady would probably go to the 1040EZ. And I think you'll find that there are pretty liberal exemptions from Social Security benefits, for example, already in the federal taxes. So by the time it gets down to the to the adjusted gross income here. I think, if I'm not mistaken, I'd have to ask, we'll take a look at that one, but I believe that in the Social Security is already, for low-income people, if that's all they have at any rate, in many cases, not even taxed at all. I happen to receive Social Security now because of my young age. I have to pay taxes on all of mine because of the other income that I receive, this heavy state legislative salary that we receive, you know, range 10. But even so, I mean, I still have to pay taxes on some of my Social Security. But I think people at the low end there, if that's essentially what they require to live upon, I don't believe that it will be taxed under here.
Representative
Crawford?
Another story that I heard, this lady was a single mother and worked at the Kmart, stocking shelves and that sort of thing. She makes a little bit under $8 an hour. Every month it's a struggle to try to get enough money together to pay the rent. Food and that sort of thing is always a struggle. If they have any sort of a medical bill where they have to, you know, buy drugs or something for the kid, I mean, she's always in a bind. How would this affect her?
I don't know. I really don't know. I think we'd have to just probably work it out to find out how it would affect her. But what we tried to do was to just simply take the wage issues, and whatever you end up with wages down on the bottom, we felt everybody should pay a very small percentage. The reason that I moved away from 15% of your taxable income, or the tax that you would pay to the federal government, to 2.25% of your adjusted gross income, is because I felt that was the fairest place to, you know, to begin your deduction from, or you know, your take from. So I don't really know, Harry. I'd have to take a look at that. It's something that you could certainly, you know, get hold of maybe somebody from the administration to try to answer your questions and hopefully satisfy your interest. My concern is that we don't get led down that path of trying to find some sort of a special exemption for every sort of special exemption. Because, you know, military retirees might look at this thing and say, well, gee, I think you ought to totally exempt all retired pay. And as a guy that receives some, I'd probably I'd like to write that in there too. But I think that the fairest way of all is to really go down to the actual list of wages and benefits taxable. In my opinion, including the permanent fund dividend, I think that, and it's been one of the concerns people have expressed, is that people in rural Alaska receive all these benefits and pay nothing. If we pass this bill, every dollar that they receive on the permanent fund dividend, for example, will become part of the taxable income amount if it fits into that, you know, that line on the federal income tax return, and will become taxable at that very low rate.
And I think if you looked at, say, like a if you're a $10 wage, you're 1% of $10. So,
yes.
Representative Crawford, you continue, and James.
Understand, and I appreciate your arguments there, but I think that's something we really need to look at. I'm going to remember that talk on the doorstep for the rest of my life, because she was at her wit's end about how, I mean, she was working a full-time job and doing everything that she could to make it, and she just wasn't making ends meet at that point, and I don't want to put a greater burden on her. Thank you.
And I urge you to look into that as to applies to the bill, and we'll do the same thing. And but I want to point out one thing, and that is that we're looking at two different elements that really serve the public. One of them is all of the services we have out there, health and social services. One of the largest assets or costs that we have in the state of Alaska. It covers everything from adult to children's medicine to foster homes to Lord knows everything else. And that's in that cost up in here that we've got $1 billion gap in. So we're trying to find a collection that will begin to fill in some of that before we run out of our savings account. So, you know, the people at the low end will pay the least and receive the most. I think that's just a fair assessment.
Representative James.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm sorry to keep butting in here with these ideas, but I just have to put it, just make this statement on the permanent fund dividend. It doesn't make a lot of sense to me to give with one hand and take it away in the other. And, you know, I have no interest, absolutely no interest, in making the permanent fund dividend a welfare program. So that means that everyone that qualifies should get the same, I believe. And it would be so simple just to reduce the permanent fund dividend by 1% if that's what we wanted to do. And we're already there, and that person doesn't even have to file a tax return. So I think that we should think about the simplicity of this issue. If we really want to get this money from them, let's take it from everyone. And then just not make them have to file if they don't have to. And it sounds to me like this lady wouldn't even have to file if that were the case.
And the cost would be either between $3 and $13 million less.
Wait till next Saturday. And hear something about personal long permanent fund.
And I've allowed a lot of latitude for the discussion because the policy issue does have to allow for the discussion of why are we even doing this and what is the problem and what's our philosophy as we approach this. So I've tried to allow as much latitude as I can to bring all the way from the struggling folks to really an economy that is somewhat disconnected from the state. And then the whole issue, like I brought up, about centralized government and some of the services we provide, just asking, can we afford to do that? Representative Hayes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And actually, I've been sitting here just listening to people talking and everything. I think one thing that we have to have in this discussion, which is not tied to anybody's bills, is we have to have a true discussion about what our general budget is, what the state, what we actually can control with 2 point whatever billion, what comes in from Senator Stevens, for the most part, 2 point X billion, and then what is the permanent fund, 1 point whatever billion. Because there's so many people who talk about our budget and say, well, we have $7.6 billion budget. We only control one third of it. One third we give away, and one third we give to somebody else. So, you know, to make this discussion a true, real, honest discussion, the people in Alaska need to know that as a legislator, we only control $2.2 billion. 2.1 comes from the feds, and 1.7 we give away, and we do an inflation proofing the permanent fund. And you know, it just amazes me how we talk about the budget, and one group of folks in this building will say one thing, and one group of folks will say another thing, just for whatever political spin they want. But the reality is, we only control a small portion of our own budget.
That's a point well taken. We have a federal strata of income between federal employees and Department of Defense, BLM. They own and operate two-thirds of the land in Alaska or more. Certainly, that economy is not under our control, and yet we are called upon to be a part of whatever we can. Certainly, the Tongass National Forest has been out of our control. I heard the other day that 10% of the state land basically is beetle infested forest, which is that is just heartbreaking. So you know, we have got some significant issues, and I agree with you, Representative, that this hall has to be a part of the discussion. So we got to grow, tax, and work our way out, and it's going to be a lot of grunt work. And I appreciate this. And I really did want to give the administration an opportunity to come in and chime in on both the policy, the process, what they are going to answer to these two bills that have been discussed today. And I'm going to allow them the opportunity to present the governor's bill next week. I will go ahead and notice that today. I will probably put it on Tuesdays. So this discussion will at least have some congruency to it. And then we can lay all these issues out on the table. Representative Hudson, it would be my intention, along with you and Representative Moses' office, to have a further discussion on some of the questions that came up today, how we can lay out maybe something that we can agree on that is maybe the best way to deal with this. Certainly, I want to weigh in on some of the things that the administration wants us to bring in, so it'll have to be after Tuesday. But I think something that we can put on the table as a committee substitute. So that's the direction I'm going to head with this.
Thank you very much.
All right. Thank you very much for your time and your chart. And now for the administration, once again,
come forward and give your name and your position in the administration, and we greatly appreciate you taking the time to be a part of this discussion.
Thank you, Representative Coghill. My name is Neil Slotnick. I am the Deputy Commissioner of Revenue. With me is Chuck Harlemert. Chuck is the Director of Operations, Chief of Operations for our Tax Division, and we also have online Mike Williams, who is a Revenue Auditor who's very knowledgeable in personal income tax.
And welcome to the committee, Mike.
And I want to say, first of all, I thank you very much for having this discussion. It's been very enjoyable for me to sit here and listen to this. I certainly want to echo the thoughts of the committee that having a budget, having a budget that is not balanced is a very unstable situation for the economy of the state of Alaska. If we want to encourage business to come here and invest in this state, I think that if they look at the situation where the budget is not balanced, it is a deterrent to investment, because who knows but that the state may have to come forward and balance the budget on the backs of business. I testified yesterday against a gross receipts tax, which I hate to testify against any revenue measure, but we felt that that was not a business-friendly friendly tax. And we believe we are going to need a broad-based tax to go forward and balance the budget here. Now, Chuck prepared for you, and we've put in your packets a chart that summarizes some of the differences and similarities between the three income tax bills that have been proposed. If you like, Mr. Chairman, I would propose that we just go down this and discuss some of the policy issues that this committee and this body is going to face as you go forward and try to fashion an income tax. The first one that you really see there on your list is the question of the tax base. Now, that's already been discussed here a little bit. You know that the tax base for the governor's bill and for Representative Moses's bill is federal tax liability. And that whereas Representative Hudson has proposed that we use as the tax base adjusted gross income. Now, there is a third possibility if you look at your 1040s. And that is actually taxable income, and on the 1040, that's going to be line 39. Adjusted gross income, as Representative Hudson pointed out, is line 33. The difference between the two is that taxable income includes the exemptions, and it also includes the deductions. Exemptions for each dependent. You get to take one exemption for yourself and then a further exemption for all of your dependents. So that is one thing that is missing. If your tax base is adjusted gross income, for wage earners who have dependents, whether it's children or elderly dependents, there is no exemption provided for that. Now, when we go to the governor's bill and Representative Moses's bill, I said that the tax base there is federal tax liability, but it is actually not clear to us as we read HB 10 what the tax base really is, because federal tax liability, first you figure out your tax from the tax tables. Is that federal tax liability? After you figured your federal tax, then you look and see whether you get any credits to apply against that tax before you end up writing your check or requesting your refund. Now, I believe Tim said that he interpreted HB 10 to apply to the amount that you owe, which would be line 70 here on your 1040. I don't think that can be right, because that's after withholding amount that you owe when you go all the way down there. So what the governor's bill does is it takes line 52, which is you can go to the tax tables, compute your tax, then subtract any credits that you may have, and this would be credits for things like there's a child care credit, which is a credit that's designed to encourage people to enter the workforce and not have to absorb all of the cost of child care. There's various other credits, including certain business credits that are included within that. That's line 52. Tax after credits. And so that's what we call federal tax liability. It's not clear to me if HB 10 goes to line 52 or if it just goes to line 39, which is taxable income. But that helps focus, I think, for this committee, the policy decisions that you're going to have to make. Do you go to AGI? And we've heard arguments from Representative James and from Representative Hudson as to why AGI has, it certainly has some, I believe, some compelling arguments in favor of that. It is the simplest and perhaps the broadest. But we've heard from Representative Crawford why it would be better to go to some what I would call more encouraging, more friendly to the people entering the workforce or on the margins of the workforce, a tax base that's more friendly towards those people at the edges. And I would submit to you that line 52 is the most friendly to those who are trying to enter the workforce. You could also look, however, at line 39, taxable income, which I believe...
I think on that point, Representative Wilson had a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For somebody that doesn't do my own taxes, mm-hmm. and this is a little confusing, is there any way by the next time or that Saturday or whenever it is we're going to be discussing this again, if you could have some examples of maybe a single mother with a child, a family of four, and some different wage so that we can see what we're talking about?
Yes, Mr. Chairman.
It would be my intention to try to get that done Tuesday if possible.
We can work that up before Tuesday.
If you